Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing well. Man, did we pick a week to record a day early. It is Tuesday, and we usually record on Wednesday, but there's so much that has happened.
So much.
Okay, so today on the show, Jasmine's going to talk to us a little bit about Andy Beshear's lawsuit against the pension bill. We wanted to get into the arguments that are being made in that court case and kind of understand the reasons why he is suing. We have tons of other stuff to talk about, though. We're going to talk about the end of the legislative session, things that were overridden, vetoes that were overridden, and last-second tweaks that were made to different bills. We're going to talk about other things that were passed and were not passed in the legislative session. Then Matt Bevin did something crazy on Friday, so we have to unpack all of that. And then yesterday, the Kentucky Education Commissioner came under fire, and I just, minute 26 of our interview with Morgan Eves, heard that he quit. So that is also in this episode, our great interview with Morgan Eves, who's a candidate for the 81st District in Richmond. You know what? Without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about the pension suit.
All right. So as promised, our Attorney General, Andy Beshear, has filed a lawsuit challenging the pension bill that was signed by the governor last week. So the Kentucky Education Association and the Kentucky State Lodge Fraternal Order of Police have also joined as plaintiffs. So it's Andy Beshear, KEA, and the FOP that are the plaintiffs. And then the defendants are Governor Bevin, Senate President Stivers, and Speaker Pro Tem David Osborne.
Right.
So the lawsuit... There's lots of allegations, but I think you can break it down into two categories. So the first one is that the bill violates the inviolable contract. So they're arguing that it ultimately reduces the retirement benefits of the over 200,000 members of the pension system, including teachers, police officers, and firefighters. And in doing so, it breaks the inviolable contract. The lawsuit alleges 15 ways that it does that. It would be really boring for me to list all 15, but among those are the cap 6 days provision, and then ending the ability of state workers from using lump sum payments for comp time as part of their salary used in calculating their pension. It lists several ways that they believe it reduces retirement benefits that they were promised when they were hired. There's not a ton of applicable case law about the inviolable contract, but there is a case that says that the inviolable contract only protects promised benefits but does not include oversight of every aspect in the process. So that means basically that, you know, you can't use the inviolable contract to keep the General Assembly from doing anything.
Right. Yeah, so it's maybe a little bit more limited than we think
right.
of.
Right, so it's not, there's this case, Jones versus Board of Trustees, it's basically saying it's not this huge, broad thing, it only protects promised benefits, but you can't use it to include the oversight of every part of it. This. So where does the inviolable contract come from? It comes from a state statute. It comes from KRS 161.714, which says, in consideration of the contributions by members and in further considerations of benefits received by the state from the members' employment, these statutes shall constitute an inviolable contract of the Commonwealth, and the benefits shall not be subject to reduction or impairment by alteration, amendment, or repeal. That's where that language comes from. So that's kind of the category of arguments number one in the lawsuit. And then I would say the next category, number two, is that they're also alleging that the legislature violated the state constitution and state statutes in the process of getting the bill rushed through.
So first thing, violations of inviolable contract.
Right. 15
second,
different ways.
15 ways to the inviolable contract was violated. Second thing, no actuarial
right.
analysis.
So the process in which the bill was passed. And they make more than just that argument. They make a couple others too, but that's one category of arguments to me. So one is that it lacked an actuarial analysis. There is a case though that says that an actuarial analysis, that statute is procedural and doesn't have any constitutional implications. So that doesn't make a law invalid per se. So even if a court said, you know, yes, they didn't follow this procedural statute, that doesn't necessarily mean that the remedy is to strike down the law because
right.
it doesn't have any constitutional implications.
Right.
They also argue that it wasn't available for public comment and that it lacked a fiscal note explaining the budget impact.
Mm-hmm. The lack of available for public comment, I mean, there's so many things throughout the history of the last 25 years in Kentucky that have been passed at the last second. I wonder
right.
if that, yeah.
and that's, you know, that's also a procedural thing that, you know, I don't think that that's makes the law invalid per se, probably.
Right.
The Bevin response, Bevin's communication director said, "The Beshears have always treated pensions as political currency, so it's no surprise that Attorney General Beshear filed this political lawsuit today."
Unbelievable.
And Beshear has requested a temporary restraining order to keep the law from going into effect while the lawsuit's pending. I think that's yet to be heard.
Right, and that would just mean that it isn't necessarily the law has been thrown out, but that it's not in effect until they decide, the court decides what to do.
Right.
Right. Yeah, so it seems like there's two main things. The first is that the content of the bill, violates the inviolable contract. And the second thing is that the process that was used to pass it was also illegal.
Yes.
All right. Well, there you go. There's the arguments that will be made in court. But now we'll talk about other things that happened in the legislature as it ended. So on the last 2 days of the legislative session, which were last Friday and Saturday, the House and Senate, they overrode the three biggest vetoes issued by Governor Bevin. So HB 362, which was the pension phase-in, we talked about it last week, that was overridden very easily, a 94-2 vote in the House and a 34-4 vote in the Senate. Last week, we talked about how the governor's issues with the bill were more about the smaller quasi-governmental groups like community health centers and libraries being able to buy themselves out of the pension system. That language actually remained in the bill that ultimately was passed over the governor's veto. So they did not listen to him. They just passed it through the way that was. I think there was a quote last week that was like, "We all like the bill as it was written." Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So they clearly liked the bill as it was written. Okay, so that was the first one. HB 200, though, the state budget, that was overridden by a straight party line vote. The governor tweeted in the middle of the debate that if no budget was passed, that he would not only call a, quote, a special session to pass a transparent and properly balanced budget and pay for it in ways that are not arbitrary and complicated. So even though the governor said, you know, we're going to stop this, I vetoed this budget because I didn't like the process, I wanted us to have a much more transparent process, we'll have a special session and do all of this, and the Democrats were like, yeah, we would prefer that to what happened, the Republicans who were in control were like, nah, we're good with what we've got, override. Lastly, HB 366, which is the revenue bill, that was enacted over the governor's veto override on a much closer vote than HB 200. So while the GOP leadership managed to pass the veto override with just a few defections in the House, the bill actually almost failed in the Senate. It passed 20-18, and Senate President Stivers cast the final vote overriding the veto. And again, if it had been 19-19, it would have failed because a 50+1 vote is required to override a veto in Kentucky. The bill was revised in some ways, including restoring a tax incentive used by major manufacturers that was deleted. Those manufacturers include Toyota and GE and other major manufacturers in the state. Other impacts were pretty unclear because there was all these revisions that were just kind of passed, and they're like, here's what we're going to pass. The upshot of the bill, though, was that it produced $396 million over the biennium, which is $80 million less than the estimate that we gave to you listeners last week. Senator Morgan McGarvey, who's a friend of the pod, he was very concerned that the estimate had changed so much with so little oversight and no hearings, and that's probably the main reason that so many people defected, and it almost failed. In addition to these overrides, the legislature also passed two other bills aimed at, quote, cleaning up, unquote, the budget. These bills address some issues realized after the budget had been passed, seeking both to clarify and to change some of the things passed in HB 200. So examples of those are restoring the age-old investor tax credit, which we talked about. I think it went in as a part of the Appalachian tax thing. Remember that? You know, that didn't pass, so they had to get it into the law somehow, so they just passed it by itself. They shoved it into one of these other bills. They passed another fix that sends more coal severance taxes to coal county school districts, and probably other stuff. The bills were very very quickly passed, and we didn't really have the chance to read them. These fixes bills, though, Jasmine, they are subject to veto, just like every other bill. And because mm-hmm. they were passed in the last 2 days, the governor can just be like, veto, and the legislature can't do anything. It can't call itself in a session to override those vetoes, and there's no more legislative days left. So if the governor doesn't like them, he can just veto them, and they're gone forever. But Jasmine, that's just what the legislature did. There are other things that they did not do. On the last 2 days of the legislature, HB 169 did, though, pass the Senate. So, Jasmine, that's the gangs bill that you are very opposed to.
Right.
Yeah. Senator Whitney Westerfield, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who's also been on the podcast, he managed to make the bill slightly less terrible by adding in language that required two of the items signifying gang membership to be present before the gang standard could apply. And he also made it more difficult for the statute to apply to juveniles. Yeah, Jasmine, you talked to us about this bill. There's like a big long list of things that mean you're in a gang, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's like three of you are hanging out.
And it's incredibly broad.
Yeah. And I think the way that the statute was originally written, if any of them happened, you were in a gang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the Whitney Westerfield substitute said you had to have two of them. One of the things that did happen was that Senator Gerald Neal, he submitted an amendment to the bill asking for a racial impact study on the bill to be added, but that was voted down.
Jason Nemes actually...
He voted against it.
He voted against it, and he got up and spoke in opposition, and he tweeted out the speech that he gave, and I thought it was very good. He said, "This bill goes too far, and yet it also doesn't go far enough." And what he means by that is, you know, it goes too far in its enhanced sentencing and that kind of thing, but doesn't go far enough in that it doesn't include any community-based programs,
right.
Educational programs in prisons and jails. So his speech was really good, and it's on Twitter.
Yeah.
If you want to listen to it.
Yeah, and just about Jason Nemes, also, he originally voted for this bill.
Yes.
The first time it passed, and because it went to the Senate, Whitney Westerfield put it in a committee substitute. He amended the bill. It passed the Senate. So it had to pass the House again, and that's when Jason Nemes voted against it. So, you know, that just goes to show you, sometimes when you call your legislators, you don't think they're listening. He changed his vote, so.
And I believe he also said that at the time that he voted for it, he believed that his Commonwealth attorney also supported it, but then found out that they didn't.
So if you're a Commonwealth attorney, maybe call your legislators more often.
Sure.
There you go. Other things, though. HB 227, the solar net metering bill, it did not pass. The Senate just decided not to take it up, which, you know what, Jasmine, small victories. We didn't have many things that we could say were good, but that didn't pass, and that was something that I really didn't like. One thing that we haven't ever talked about on the show is Kentucky Wired. We probably should do that because that's a big thing that's going on with the state government. But the legislature actually almost decided not to fund this huge program that's trying to bring broadband to the whole state. This is a really complicated decision because it's a big program that hasn't really been able to show a lot of benefit yet. But not funding it would have been really terrible for Kentucky's credit rating. On the last day of the legislative session, the state authorized $110 million in borrowing for the project. And we'll tell you more about that someday. The last thing about this is that the legislature did not pass any funding mechanism for charter schools. So
what does that mean?
Basically, okay, so public schools get money based on the SEEK formula, and charter schools get funding based on nothing, because all that the legislature did last year was allow for them to exist.
Right. So as far as the future of them not happening right now because there's no funding mechanism?
Well, you know, you could start one, but there would be no way to get any money. You'd basically just be able to start a school and call it a charter school. Yeah,
okay.
I don't really know if what that would be, how that's different from a private school. But yeah, that people expected for there to be some sort of mechanism to fund charter schools, figure out how that would work, but there was none this year. Jasmine, that's what the legislature did on the last 2 days. But Matt Bevin was also very busy. You saw this video, didn't you?
Yes, of course I did.
Of course you did. This is a weekend, right? It was filled with wild stories. But I really do think the wildest one was Matt Bevin's comments. There was a pool of reporters outside the Capitol. Matt Bevin's talking. You've probably seen this video, but if you haven't, here's the money quote. Quote, "I guarantee you, somewhere in Kentucky today, a child was sexually assaulted that was left at home because there was nobody there to watch them. I guarantee you, somewhere today, a child was physically harmed or ingested poison because they were home alone because a single parent didn't have any money to take care of them. I'm offended by the idea that people so cavalierly and so flippantly disregarded what's truly best for children." Unquote. Jasmine, rate my Matt Bevin impression.
My mom said you didn't sound mean enough.
Oh, gosh. Well,
on
you know
your
what?
Last one.
So was my Matt Bevin impression better or worse than the actual comments that he made?
Oh, I don't know.
Those are both really bad. My impression's
really
bad. The comments themselves
right.
are really terrible, too.
The comments are worse, probably.
Yeah. Jasmine, there were other weird parts about this quote, including a part that were about teachers taking off their shoes and smoking. This all boils down to me. national outlets got a hold of talking points from what's called the State Policy Network, which is a Koch-funded ideas factory. I don't know what an ideas factory. I think it might be like a think tank, but maybe that word doesn't mean what it does anymore. Anyways, it's this Koch-funded ideas factory, and these talking points included this as point one, quote, teacher strikes hurt kids and low-income families, unquote. And they had, like, all this language that Republicans and conservatives were trying to use about these teacher strikes and how they could, like, frame them as bad. And the language actually in the document was much softer. And I really think if the governor had just followed the script that he was given, he wouldn't be in this much hot water. But he decided to kick his language up a notch and say things like children were being poisoned and sexually assaulted.
Right. And so didn't his, like, initial... like budget cut proposal include like cutting the poison control center.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yes.
Now he's upset about kids being poisoned.
Right. It's ridiculous. Anyways, this exchange was caught on tape by several reporters, but Marcus Green of WDRV, he got the video out first and it went viral. National outlets published stories and the governor's comments earned him two resolutions of condemnation from the Kentucky House on Saturday. So that was pretty impressive because the Kentucky House has, you know, 61 Republicans and, you know, he got condemned by them. On Sunday, though, the next day, the governor actually released a video that he billed as an apology. The video is 4 minutes long, and here are just a few of the quotes. Quote, I apologize to those who have been hurt by the things that were said. It was not my intent. Unquote.
No. Like that right there. Like,
apologize to those who have been hurt for the things that were said. It was not my intent. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you're hurt.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you're hurt. Okay, another thing. Clearly, a tremendous number of people did not fully appreciate what I was communicating, and I hurt a lot of people. So clearly, you idiots didn't understand what I was saying. And a third thing. Many people have been confused or hurt or just misunderstand what it was I was trying to communicate. Again, misunderstanding. People are misunderstanding what's going on. And the last one two more I wanted to highlight. Quote, the responsibility for communicating things falls on the person doing the speaking. This case is an example of me doing that poorly. Unquote. That's not a direct quote, but that's pretty close. I think that's a little better. It's getting a little warmer, right? Maybe a little bit. Yeah. And the last one, I'm sorry for those of you who have been hurt by the things that I've said. Which, that's pretty direct, I guess. There's tons of Democrats and friends of teachers and state workers who pretty roundly criticized the video as not actually an apology and more of like a deflection, just saying people misunderstanding. And many people have honed in on the part of the video which said that people misunderstood what he was saying, James Kay and Allison Lundgren Grimes being particular examples of that. And many Republicans have actually accepted the apology. Jasmine, I think if this video wasn't 4 minutes long and he wasn't just like rambling about people misunderstanding, and if he was just like, hey, I'm sorry, like he did do in like very small portions of this video, if he had just said that, he'd be in better shape. But again, he just wanted to talk more.
Yeah, I mean, every time he said, I'm sorry, though, it was, I'm sorry that you've misunderstood me. And I'm almost just like getting tired of this because this seems to happen every time he makes like outlandish comments.
I was shocked that he had any sort of apology whatsoever. He usually just jumps right into saying it's your fault for feeling stupid.
Right. Well, he made one prior like apology to teachers the last time he said something about them, like after that radio show.
That's
and
right.
It was similar to this, but shorter. And I guess he said, I'm sorry, less in that one probably. But it's not an apology. Like it's sorry, not sorry.
Right.
Basically.
Okay. Yeah. You know, yeah. To me, I don't know how useful it is to be like, this wasn't an apology or this was an apology. I think the most important thing is that clearly the governor doesn't like the teachers who are trying to have their voices heard and wish they would just let him pass changes to their pensions without any opposition. You know, he just doesn't like them. And you know, that's what we should take away from this, is that he doesn't like you and that he wants to do stuff to you and not have you talk about him. And that's not good. I think the key thing here is not whether or not he's sincere in his apology. The most important thing is that he is sincerely trying to take away teachers' pensions and that you're really getting under his skin by going out and protesting him. So, whew, that was just such a crazy story. I mean, I was so wild that took off.
I know, like, I heard people, I'm, like, never on the internet during the day because I'm always in court. And so, like, I start hearing things like, oh, Matt Bevin said this crazy thing, and I'm just like, oh, you know, it's, you know, pretty run of the mill. But Saying that kids were getting sexually assaulted and poisoned was kind of a new one.
No, you know what, though? I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I hear what you're saying because I heard the same thing. People were actually like, Matt Bevin said this crazy thing. And I was like, Matt Bevin always says crazy things.
Right.
People are like awake about this now.
I know. I think the radio show one was more publicized than a lot of his prior comments. And then this one especially. But he's been saying these things forever.
Since he was
I don't know.
Somebody reminded me of when he was a candidate in 2015 and like stormed into the Kentucky Democratic Party office and like yelled at the secretary. Jasmine, that's crazy.
Right.
That's a crazy thing to do. And it was just people were just like not paying attention or like whatever. It wasn't top of mind for whatever reason and didn't catch on. And then he continued to he would go on Terry Miners and say crazy things all the time. But now he's paying a price. And I think it has to do with the fact that he's actually putting into place policies that are hurting people and getting people to pay attention. And now, you know, he's actually paying a price, a political price for the crazy things he said all along.
Right. Yeah. This has been happening for over 3 years now. And I'm glad that people are finally noticing.
He got caught at a cockfighting ring. Like, he got caught with chickens fighting. That's so illegal.
That was back from, was that
when
back
he was
from
running
his
for
Senate?
Senate. Yeah. I mean, come on now. This has been going on forever. All right. Anyways, Jasmine, we were going to end the show here, but then, I mean, there was more news. There's no stopping the news this week. Yesterday on April 16th, that's a Monday, the Education and Workforce Development Secretary and former Republican gubernatorial candidate Hal Heiner, he abruptly resigned his job and took one of seven appointments that Matt Bevin made to the Kentucky Board of Education. We've talked a lot about Bevin and boards since we started the show. This is one that he basically like respected. He didn't try to dismiss everybody, but he did randomly have seven appointments, which is enough for a majority on the Board of Education. Hal Heiner used to be a Louisville Metro Council member and has run for Louisville mayor, Kentucky governor in the past. He's a fierce critic of JCPS and has advocated for charter schools and vouchers and everything associated with conservative education policy. The seven new members of the State Board of Education now give Bevin appointees a majority on the board, and the new board immediately set a specially called meeting for today, April 17th. The agenda was, quote, for discussion of the appointment, discipline, or dismissal of an individual employee, unquote, which that immediately set off a whole bunch of alarm bells that the job of the current education commissioner, Stephen Pruitt, was in serious jeopardy. So Stephen Pruitt, he's been the state's education commissioner since 2015, taking the job at the very, very end of Governor Beshear's final term. So Jasmine, I've just said a bunch of information here. So mm-hmm. A note, first of all, on these positions. So Education and Workforce Development Secretary, that's Hal Heiner, who up until yesterday, that's a cabinet job. So whenever a governor comes into office, he gets to fill that with whoever he wants. And every governor has somebody, and that person's basically in charge of putting the governor's policy priorities about the education system into practice. He works directly for the governor. The State Board of Education is an 11-member board that controls regulations of K-12 education in the state. We talked a lot about boards, but they have staggered terms. They're supposed to not all be controlled by, like, one governor or whatever. But randomly, Matt Bevin did have, like, seven appointees and took over a majority of the board. And the last thing is the Education Commission, and that's the chief executive of the Kentucky Department of Education. They're hired, and they report to the State Board of Education. So, you know, they hired somebody, and that person basically just is in charge of the executive functions of the State Board of Education. Okay, that's the note on positions. So in early 2017, Stephen Pruitt began an audit of JCPS. It has not yet been delivered. Many people have speculated that a goal of the audit for the Bevin administration was to see a full takeover of JCPS by state government, which would mean basically the school board in Louisville would lose all of its power and the State Board of Education would essentially come in and start running the school district however they wanted to, which would mean basically that Matt Bevin and a much more conservative set of people would be running the school district in Jefferson County. And there's nothing to stop them. Jasmine, you know about the 10th Amendment, right? Which
right.
is basically like the national government can't do this for states. There is no 10th Amendment for cities. So basically state governments can do whatever they want to their cities that reside within those states. So last night, JCPS had a school board meeting, and a member, Chris Brady, he spoke out about the audit, and he said that before today, the audit called for more state assistance from JCPS, but not a full takeover. And the reason he said that is that, quote, this is the one chance to get out of the public what is going on with the district before some in Frankfurt put out their own story and try to control the narrative, unquote. So basically, Chris Brady is very afraid that whatever's going on with Hal Heiner and with Stephen Pruitt, that they're basically machinations going on behind the scenes to be able to control the narrative about this audit that Stephen Pruitt was working on up until today. You know, I wrote this last one and no longer means anything. So, Jasmine, like I said, the next thing that's going to happen in the show is we have a great interview with Morgan Eaves. But in minute 26 of this interview, my phone dings. You can actually hear it in the interview. So if you're listening closely, 26 minutes into the interview, my phone will ding and it will be a notification from the Herald Leader saying that Stephen Pruitt has resigned after a 4.5-hour-long meeting with the State Board of Education. So he is no longer has that job. That actually did come to pass. And we don't know anything else about that. So basically, this is a very developing story, and we'll definitely be talking about it next week. But I'm not sure who's going to be put in place, but clearly it will be somebody much more aligned with the governor and more supportive of charter schools and vouchers and other more conservative policies, much more along the lines of Hal Heiner. But I don't know if he's going to take that job because he's on the board now.
Right.
And I did read in the story very briefly while you were talking about the lawsuit that it doesn't seem like Hal Heiner wants to be the chairman of the Board of Education. He's just going to serve on the board. So there you go.
Okay. Crazy stuff.
It is crazy. There's all kinds of crazy stuff. I did have like a really quick hit down here, which is that the Trump administration has decided that Louisville is not a sanctuary city in violation of federal immigration law, which that's something we've talked about on the show before.
We have.
Wanted to update that. Whoosh. Jasmine, how about that?
A lot going on.
There's a lot.
And the session's over.
And yeah, this is supposed to be the slow week. It was not. Yeah, we have that interview with Morgan Eaves coming up. She's in Richmond, running for the 81st district against C. Wesley Morgan, who's quite the character. Yeah, so we'll listen to that right now.
Morgan Eaves is the Democratic candidate for the 81st House District in Richmond, Kentucky. She currently serves as a city commissioner in Richmond and works as an attorney. She is an alum of the Emerge program, like many other women that we've interviewed on My Old Kentucky podcast. She is likely running against C. Wesley Morgan, a freshman legislator who we've talked about several times on the show before. Until 2016, the 81st district had been represented by a Democrat at least since 1981. So, Morgan, thank you for coming on My Old Kentucky podcast to talk to us.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be on my first podcast.
All right. Unlike several of the other candidates that we've spoken to, though, you already hold a political office. So tell us why you decided to run for the Kentucky legislature instead of running for re-election of the Richmond City Commission.
Well, there's a couple different reasons. It became really obvious after the 2016 election that a lot of people were ignited and were going to step up in the next election cycle and run for office. And that was definitely the case with the Richmond City Commission. Pretty soon after my term as a commissioner started, there were a lot of young people that came up to me and wanted to know if I thought they would be good commissioners or had an interest in running during the next election cycle. So I was confident that there were going to be really good candidates to make smart decisions and help propel Richmond forward in 2018 and beyond. And around the same time, it became really obvious that our elected representative in Frankfort, one, had no idea what he was doing, and two was only there to represent himself and further his own interests. So with those two factors combining, I felt confident that Richmond had a secure future and that we had to get this guy out of Frankfort and get someone in there that was willing to represent more than just themselves. So that's why I decided against remaining on the commission and moving towards state government.
So what about state government interests you that you feel maybe couldn't be accomplished at the city government level?
So going back to people being ignited in the 2016 election, I was one of those people. After the election results came in, not only at a national level, but also at a statewide level, it just became really apparent that we had a bunch of people who were not making the right decisions for the future of our Commonwealth, particularly the right to work and charter mm-hmm. schools. The votes really angered me. And in terms of what I can accomplish in Frankfort versus locally, Madison County runs on education. I mean, we have EKU, Berea College, and a ton of public schools through the State Department of Education, our local school system, that really fuel our economy. And we have people in Frankfort that just aren't making decisions to strengthen those systems. That's the kind of thing that I can help propel forward and stabilize in Frankfort versus locally. Locally, I could really only be a cheerleader for our educators. And in Frankfort, I can be more of a proactive helping hand.
And I think Richmond definitely needs someone to stand up for education right now. I think most people have heard EKU cut a lot of programs recently.
Yeah, and the people that those cuts affect aren't just people in Madison County, but they're the lesser served people in Appalachia
right.
that come to regional universities like EKU to try to get education so that they can provide themselves with a better life. So it's not just affecting our local economy. It's affecting a whole region of Kentucky that has a history of being really disenfranchised.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your district. The 81st was one of the closest elections in 2016, with Representative Morgan defeating Representative Scott by 76 votes, and Jim Gray getting more votes than Rand Paul in the district. Are you surprised that more Democrats didn't enter the primary in this district?
Well, I'm not surprised, and I'll tell you why. It's because I've been working undercover for a while, trying to not only talk to party leaders in Frankfort, but just get a sense of whether people here would support me, and sort of trying to scare off the competition.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, so I've been working undercover, but I feel like the party itself is really, really represented statewide, both in the primary and the general. But I'm happy that people feel confident enough in me and what I want to accomplish in Frankfort and what I've already accomplished in Richmond that they sort of wholeheartedly put their faith in me and have allowed me to go uncontested. And I'm really excited about that because I think it frees up what I can do until
right,
the general
and focusing
election.
On November. Sure. The 81st district roughly matches the city of Richmond. People talk a lot about, you know, the rural versus urban divide in our politics, and we feel like small cities like Richmond sometimes get kind of swallowed in that debate. So tell us what you would do as a representative of a small city.
Absolutely. Richmond struggles a lot because we're so close to Lexington. Especially being on the city commission, I see a lot of revenue just sort of bleed into other communities because they're larger and are more traditionally appealing to people when they want to invest their money. But Madison County is a very interesting place. Richmond has EKU, mm-hmm. which is very sort of traditional university atmosphere. Then Berea has Berea College, which is, if you've never been to Berea, you have to go. It is so, I mean, it's a very hard atmosphere to describe, but it's very heavy on craft and artisanship, and there's such a sense of community. But even though there's a college there, it's such a different atmosphere than Richmond. Mm-hmm. And then in between, you have working farms and a lot of rural aspects. I think what Madison County and the 81st District needs right now, and what I'll be able to provide, is representation. We have a representative right now who has never come to a city commission meeting in Richmond, who has never come to a city commission meeting in Berea. I have never seen him at a public event, whether it's in Richmond or Berea or one of the rural communities. You cannot represent people if you're not out among them and talking to them. And that is such a lack of basic appreciation for the people that put you in office. And I know because of what I did during my city commission run and what I've continued to do since since then that I have a better understanding of everyone in the community, whether it's people in Berea, people in Richmond, or a farmer that's trying to work his cattle and make a dollar. And that representation is what we need.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, your support. So as of the last update that we've been able to see, you've raised significantly more money than your opponent, and most of that money comes from individual contributions. So talk to us a little bit about your approach to fundraising and how you plan to use your fundraising advantage in this election.
Yeah, that's sort of the worst part about campaigning, and I'm sure everyone will tell you that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's unfortunate that you have these corporations that can come in like they've done in the last two election cycles and bring in this quote-unquote dark money, which is more than an individual would ever be able to contribute, especially in a largely rural area like the 81st District. So my approach to fundraising is to value the $25 contribution as much as you value the $2,000 contribution. Mm-hmm. It's just getting out there and making your beliefs and what you want to accomplish known to people. And the more they connect with you, the more willing they're able to invest in you. And that's what a contribution is. It's an investment. And I'm shocked that I'm getting contributions not only from people in Madison County, but I got a max donation a couple weeks ago from a woman in Louisville that I'd never heard of and never met. And that is really exciting to me because it shows me that not only do people around the state pay attention to what's going on in local government, but that they want to change. And yeah, and you know, in terms of what I'm going to do with all of my contributions, I would love to know what campaigning was like back in the day when you just went around and did literal stump speeches. but now it's so different. You know, billboards, I have billboards that cost alone $30,000 plus. Yes. I need to go into the billboard business after realizing how much they cost. But you know, I'm not going to do anything crazy. Billboards, social media, mailers. But I think a lot of what I want to do myself that Representative Morgan paid people to do for his 2016 election was I want to canvass myself.
Right.
He paid people to do that. He did, as far as I know, he did not knock on any doors. And for city commission, I knocked on over 3,000 by myself. I did not have any help. So I think that's the way to win an election, is to get out there, have FaceTime, and that's free. If I can do that a couple hours after work every day, I can get a huge chunk of my district by myself. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I need volunteers and need help, but that's something that I think people see a lot of value in, and you get a lot of return on investment just on that free canvassing.
Absolutely. Well, okay, so let's talk a little bit about your opponent. So you don't seem like,
yes,
in the discussions we've had with you just now, you don't seem like you're afraid to run against him very much, which is good. But he's been a pretty interesting person, I think, in his first term here in Frankfort. So early in his term, he found himself in the middle of several scandals. This isn't news to you, but it may be to some of our listeners. He failed to pay property taxes on his houseboat and was charged with breaking several laws about liquor stores that he then tried to change as a legislator. But then this year, it's been kind of interesting because in the midst of the Jeff Hoover saga, he's kind of like emerged as this constant critic of his own party, and he actually voted against the pension and sewer bill. So, you know, it's not as straightforward as running against like a Phil Moffat or a Stan Lee or something like that. So we'd like to hear your particular approach to campaigning against Representative Morgan.
Yes, it's an interesting but short legislative history, that is for sure. You know, the whole Hoover thing was interesting because, and I totally give props to him. He did the right thing by condemning someone who was in a leadership position who should never have engaged in an unsavory, illegal behavior. And he did the right thing by condemning him. Absolutely. The interesting thing is how much attention he got for doing the right thing.
Right.
And that's because he had no history of doing the right thing. And we should expect people that we put into these coveted positions to always do the right thing, to always further our interests and not their own. So the fact that it was such a huge deal that this one time when he should have done the right thing and he didn't, I think that speaks volumes
right.
about his character and his past, that people were blown away that he finally made the right decision. You know, what I find with him is he really, really tries to nationalize everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if all you have is that I voted for Hillary Clinton, I mean, which must be a shock to people that a Democrat voted for a Democrat. If all you have is that I voted for Hillary Clinton and you think that's going to win you the race, you don't have anything. And you're out of touch with your constituency. And again, he hasn't accomplished anything in the legislature. He hasn't gotten a single bill heard. And the only thing he's introduced is to try to run over protesters and, you know, to try to
right.
get himself a little bit more money, you know, out of his liquor stores and his houseboat. He hasn't helped anyone in Madison County, and he can't escape that fact no matter how he tries to campaign. I'm prepared for the personal remarks, the insults. I'm prepared for it. And I'm okay with it because that's just what he does. He's very much a student of Donald Trump and Matt Bevin.
Mm-hmm.
He's seen that those tactics have worked, but I think those tactics are, you see locally and nationally, they've reached their expiration point. People don't see through those like they used to, you know, and his pension sewer bill thing, I think he just knew he had to do something to save his seat. So he voted no.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been sort of putting on social media that he stands up to his party. And that's an interesting statement because when your party is in the supermajority and you're a black sheep in that party, you're not going to get anything accomplished.
Right.
So you're asking people to vote for someone who's acknowledging they can't get anything done. You know, so campaigning against him is just take it as it comes, but always go back to the message that this is not a national race. Nationalizing it means you're out of touch with your constituents. And, you know, going back to his record, which is laughable.
Right. Yeah, I was writing down all the things that he'd done in his first term, and I totally forgot that he introduced the bill to run over protesters. But, yes, he did that
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Matt Bevin,
yes.
and you're actually the first candidate that we've spoken to since the governor's statement this Friday about the teachers' actions in Frankfort causing children to be sexually assaulted, poisoned, and drug addicted because the teachers weren't
yeah.
in school on Friday. What's your particular reaction to the governor's statements?
Oh, man, it was disgusting, disappointing, but not surprising.
Absolutely.
This is someone who, from the very beginning of their candidacy for governor, has insulted other candidates. Since he's been in office, he has insulted on a regular basis the attorney general. He insulted union members that were protesting right to work. And he's continuing to assault teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so proud of teachers and state workers and law enforcement and all of their supporters that have just continued to push back. Because if things weren't as desperate as they are, you know, they may not have chosen to protest and to rally. But the fact that they have is such an indication of how desperate things are.
Right.
And he should be applauding those people for participating in the process.
Right. Absolutely. So, yeah, the words themselves were very bad. Absolutely. I think we're all in agreement there. But beyond those words, we're actually interested in your opinion about the policy and tactics that got the budget and pension reforms pushed through the legislature this session. You know, they included significant cuts, tax cuts for rich people, increased taxes for poor people. Just generally, what do you think about the policy and the budget and the revenue bills that were passed through this year?
I think they're generally abhorrent. And I think that they don't accomplish anything. And it was wild to me the way they pushed the pension sewer bill through when not even everyone on the committee had a copy of the bill before them. And certainly every member that was voting in the larger legislature hadn't read it. They hadn't read the budget. They hadn't read the tax bill. There was no study for the tax bill or the pension bill. It was shocking. And the argument that, well, the Democrats did this too, they did this years ago with the same processes, that's not an argument that should allow us to perpetrate that sort of action. In fact, it's gotten us to this point, so we should want to change course. The revenue bill, I especially have a problem with because they praised, you know, leadership praised it as being such a great bill. We're going to raise so much revenue. But again, like you said, you're punishing the middle and lower classes. You're rewarding big corporations, and you're not really raising that much revenue. Every other Democrat in the state will tell you that we need to legalize medical marijuana and legalize gambling. Those are two very easy solutions to our stagnant economy and to finding funding for our pension system.
Absolutely.
And the fact that people can raise their hand and say we did a great job because we lowered taxes for everyone, but we're also going to institute taxes, service taxes that will punish people that make less every day, that just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, we're not learning from states like Tennessee that are suffering under their consumption taxes. And the pension thing, it was, I'm sure you all watched the hearings and have probably rewatched the committee meetings, but Representative Jim Wayne was so on point when he told, I think it was Representative Carney in the committee meeting, that he saw what he was doing from a strategic point of view because he wanted more votes
mm-hmm.
when he got home in November. And that is so true. You're pushing something through that no one has read, that no one has studied, and that really does nothing to fund the pension.
Right.
You're not addressing any revenue, any new revenue, which everyone acknowledges is the problem. So it's frustrating because it's such a circle, and it's obvious that they felt like they had to do something just to go home and say they did it.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's a half-hearted attempt that people see through, and that's really obvious. But the way they were pushed through, sneaky, backdoor, untransparent, it should make everyone angry.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of Jim Wayne, we actually usually at this point ask about HB 29, which is his tax bill, his tax reform bill that he's had before the legislature for about a decade at this point. We can't ask about that anymore because a lot of the elements of that were actually passed in the revenue bill this year. We are interested in what your opinion is about tax reform and about increased revenue and whether you're committed to supporting a bill or sponsoring a bill during the next budget year, which would increase revenue in the state.
Jim Wayne is such a jewel, and I am so sad that he's retiring. But he stood up when they were talking about the revenue bill and was fairly impassioned, and he has a right to be considering he's been proposing comprehensive tax reform for 10 years. And he very passionately said, this is not tax reform. And I 100% agree with him. And absolutely, I would be in favor of introducing or co-sponsoring legislation that actually earns us revenue.
Awesome.
That closes all these corporate loopholes and that legalizes some of the things that could bring in substantial dollars.
Great. Yeah, that's good. We're going to add you to the yes column. Jasmine's been keeping score for us this whole session. So, outside of revenue, pensions, and budgets, these financial issues that have really dominated the year, of course, there's a million other things that are very important to our state. So we're interested, what are the other issues that made you so passionate that you wanted to run for office?
So I've already talked about education, and Madison County has been suffering for years because the legislature continues to cut funding especially for higher education. EKU is the largest job provider in Madison County, only second to the Madison County school system. So wherever funding is cut, we're impacted. And not only from an economic standpoint in the short term, retaining those jobs that the school system and the university provides, but I'm someone who benefited from higher education, and I know the difference it can make in someone's life and in the direction of that person's life. And that is not only a short-term economic benefit, it's a long-term economic benefit. And seeing two rounds of cuts, job cuts at EKU in the last probably 4 or 5 years, and how that's affected the local economy is just gutting to me.
Right.
That's not only affecting those teachers, that's affecting those students who were under that mentorship of those teachers. So that was one of the main things that really impassioned me, because it's such a local issue, but it's obviously such a broader and wider issue.
Yeah, it's something that's very important to your district, for sure.
Yeah, and also something that's affecting everyone statewide is the opioid epidemic and the larger drug epidemic. We in Madison County, over the last 10 years, I think our criminal docket and our indictments have gone up like 500%.
Wow.
And our jail, I think our jail is the most overcrowded in the state, and we're having to pay other communities to take our inmates because we have such a concentrated drug problem. And we're lucky to be located on I-75, but we're also, you know, cursed by it, because it's been proven that it is a major thoroughfare for drug transporting.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that ends up right here in our backyard. So focusing on finding funding for addicts and getting them to treatment and punishing the dealers and the higher ups is something that I'm passionate about, because I've seen how it's affected the community.
Absolutely.
And especially being on city commission, it's caused a lot of blight in our city, and it's something that we've addressed pretty frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always brainstorming how to solve it. And I want to work with other people who are smarter than me and who know more than I do, get the help for people that they need.
Right. Yeah, that's something that we've heard repeated by several different people running for office that want to address that specific issue. So hopefully you guys all win so we can do something about this serious problem that's facing our state. Before we let you go, how can people learn more about you or get in touch with you if they're interested?
Well, they can tweet me. It's at Morgan Eves, KY. My website is evesforstaterep.com, and I'm on Facebook, Morgan Eves for State Representative.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us today on My Old Kentucky Podcast, and we really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be interviewed.
All right. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page, read our show notes on Medium, and find our podcast on the podcast app of your choice.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.